Indeed. Here I am. What an opportunity we have. Professor Jim Bell is our guest. He's an associate professor in the Cornell University Astronomy Department. He received his B.S. degree from Caltech and his Ph.D. from the University of Hawaii. He's a guy who runs Spirit and Opportunity. Those little machines we have scurrying around much more of Mars than we originally anticipated. And we've been asking him, I hope, a lot of questions that a lot of you wanted answered. And we'll get some of the, you know, the more complex stuff. Richard Hoagland, Big Dick, sent a number of questions, which we will pummel the professor with shortly. But we've been doing some basics on Mars, and they certainly are fascinating and a little worrisome from my point of view. As I mentioned to the professor, what happened there, and he agrees, could well occur here, and that's a good reason for studying Mars and the other planets in our system and any other system we're able to reach. Listen, at some point during the weekend, I wanted to mention this. Being here on the opposite side of the world in the Philippines has been just a wonderful, fascinating experience. However, I don't have a lot of friends here, and anybody in a similar situation, I certainly would like to hear from you. Coming to the opposite side of the world is kind of like, I don't know, when you leave high school, you have a whole bunch of friends, and for a while you stay in touch, and then you kind of drift apart. Well, same deal after college, and same deal when you move to the other side of the earth. You have a lot of friends, and, you know, as it sinks in that you're on the other side of the earth, you kind of drift apart. So if there are any other Americans here that are married to Filipinas, I'd certainly love to meet you. And toward that end, and any other end, if you'd like to get hold of me, here is the way you do it. I'm Art Bell at AOL.com, or perhaps better, Art Bell at Mindspring.com. That's A-R-T-B-E-L-L at Mindspring, M-I-N-D. S-P-R-I-N-G.com, Art Bell at Mindspring.com, and I certainly, on any subject, would love to hear from you. In a moment, we continue with Professor Bell. Well, all right, let's get a couple of things out of the way very quickly. Professor Bell, the face on Mars. Do the latest images that we've received of the face on Mars, do they make it a dead issue? Is it Richard Hoagland, I've done many shows, I'm sure you've heard him many times, with Richard. He sees things that I don't. I see rocks most times when he sees faces, but these latest images, is it a dead issue now?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, it's the latest images that have been coming down across the planet are spectacular, and they show, you know, amazing landforms. I don't know if that, I don't personally think that features a face, but do I think it that makes it less spectacular? No. As a geologist, as someone who admires beautiful photography, space photography, you know, they're beautiful landforms. I want to understand what causes mesas and knobs and hills and dales and channels and other things on Mars, and so do the, you know, the folks that I know who work on this. And the approach that that people like that are taking, I think it's reasonable. You know, you put forth a hypothesis, and you come up with tests to test the hypothesis, and you see if your idea matches what's coming back in the data. And you know, just because I haven't been swayed or others haven't been swayed doesn't mean you should stop. I mean, just, you know, ask people like Copernicus and Galileo, right?
Sure.
But you know, my bottom, if you want a bottom line answer, is I guess I don't believe that features like that are artificial. They seem perfectly natural, and the higher resolution data seems to be consistent with that. But I have no problem with the with people who want to investigate that further and put forth ideas that others can test. I think that's a great thing.
Well, I guess I was referring to the latest. I mean, certainly the early images really did make it look like a face. I mean, there was no question about
it.
Oh,
sure.
It looked like a face.
No, absolutely. The Viking images with the certain, you know, data dropouts and sun angles and all that, absolutely. And you know, as humans, we're programmed to see faces and lots of nature as well as
you
each
bet.
Other. So, no, that's absolutely. And so it was certainly something worth looking into in more detail. And I guess my opinion based on looking at the data and you know, reading a whole bunch of studies and both sides is that the new data that have come down since Viking just don't support that hypothesis.
However, let me ask this. In the early days, Professor, when it really did look like a face, mm-hmm. was there within NASA a group that thought, you know, maybe it is a face?
I don't know, Art. I mean, I was only 8 years old at the time, so I really can't tell you. I know that what I can tell you is that, I mean, seriously, I think it was in high school at the time, and, you know, it part of the reason that people are so fascinated by Mars is because of things like that, because of enigmas, both real and imagined, going all the way back to Percival Lowell and before. It's a place that we can picture ourselves being. It's a place that we can project, you know, a civilization like ours onto because it seems familiar, and that's part of the allure of Mars. And I would be, you know, I'd be dishonest if I said that things like the face on Mars controversy, you know, didn't sort of get me a little inspired about studying Mars and learning more about the mysteries and enigmas of our solar system. So, I think on balance, it's a net positive thing, and I'm not, you know, one of these, you know, anti-face fighters, you know, that gets all hung up about it. I just want to see good science done, and that involves posing hypotheses and testing them, and I think that's what a lot of people are doing. I like to see
yes,
that.
It does. All right, circulating around the internet recently. There has been a photograph apparently taken by one of your cute little machines of what absolutely looks like a skull. Now, I'm sure you've seen this photograph. Comments?
I don't know exactly which one you're talking about, and I'm not trying to be coy, to be honest with you, because I've seen an enormous number of rocks and landforms that, you know, one could say, oh, kind of looks like a skull, or it looks like a funny rock, or whatever. But I don't know exactly which one you're talking about, to be
really?
Honest.
Maybe one of my web gurus back there can get it quickly posted up
okay,
on the site somewhere.
I'd be happy to look at that, yeah.
It's really, it does look like a skull. It
cool.
really does.
Cool. You know,
okay.
And I once in a while, I'll get emails from folks who say, oh, you know, I saw this funny shape in this image, and, you know, did you guys look at that? You know, we are looking at all the images, of course. And there's ambiguity, I think, in a lot of these things, especially when you get right down to the limit of resolution of the camera or the microscope. So I personally haven't seen anything that I would say, oh, that's a skull, or that's a femur, or that's a, you know, a piece of whatever, a bacterial strand, or, you know, I haven't seen anything like that. Others claim they have. I just haven't been convinced.
All right, here are a few questions from Big Dick, Richard Hoagland. How much Mars astronomy can be done with the rover pan cams? What are the engineering constraints, power, lighting, computer memory, and so forth? Can you actually do Mars astronomy with them?
Yes, actually, and we have, and I had an article in Sky and Telescope a few months ago, Sky and Telescope magazine, called Backyard Astronomy from Mars, because we had the luxury situation back in the summer of 2005 of being able to have so much power that we could run the rovers at night as well as the daytime.
Wow.
And this is when it was summer at the landing sites, and we had so much solar power coming in. The solar panels were kept pretty clean by the dust, by the wind, clean of dust by the wind. That we could wake up the rovers at night and do some astronomy. Now, the cameras on the rovers that my group runs here at Cornell are not telescopes. They're cameras. And it's mm-hmm. sort of the equivalent of taking a 100-millimeter lens on a 35-millimeter camera, if you're familiar with photography.
I am.
So it's not like looking through a telescope. It's just like taking your camera out in your backyard. So you're still seeing primarily stars. We're not, you know, zooming in and seeing the rings of Saturn or any of that kind of stuff. But still, there are some cool things to see in the night sky of Mars, and particularly the two moons of Mars, Phobos and Deimos, are the most prominent things in the night sky of Mars moving across the sky. And it turned out that, we looked into this early on, it turned out that the orbits of those moons hadn't been carefully monitored by astronomers since the late 1980s. And so we had a way, sitting on the surface, to measure the positions of the moons against the background stars and just update the orbits of the moons. And Phobos, for example, is really close to Mars, and it's slowly spiraling into Mars. It's going to take It's going to take millions of years, but it is slowly spiraling in, so its orbit is changing slowly. And so we were actually able to do some measurements from the surface to refine its orbit. And we can also see the moons pass in front of the sun in little mini solar eclipses from the surface. And so we've done that with the rovers also. Now, we could only do it for a short period of time when it was summertime at the landing site of Spirit. We couldn't do it with Opportunity because one of the heaters on Opportunity stuck on at night, and it uses up an enormous amount of power, and we just didn't have enough power to run that rover at night. But Spirit doesn't have that problem. So for a short period of time, for about 35 nights or so, we were able to run an observatory, in quotes, on another planet. And, boy, as an astronomer here, it was great fun, and we were doing some pretty good science, too.
So what you discovered is that eventually, millions of years, albeit, Phobos will crash into Mars.
We didn't discover that with the rovers. That was known beforehand. But the rate that was happening has not been monitored very well since the late 1980s. And so we're providing some new data to monitor that the way that orbit is changing.
Will that be a steady decay, or will it speed up at some point as the gravitational pull gets greater?
It'll be, it's predicted to be steady until the thing actually starts interacting with the upper atmosphere, which will be very, very late. So it'll be steady over the next few millions of years.
Boy, that'd be something to see.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
All right. What about our own moon? Is our own moon absolutely stable in its orbit, or is it also slowly decaying?
Well, yeah, our own moon is slowly moving away from us, actually. When I was a kid, there was this wonderful science fiction TV series called Space 1999. Maybe you watched it, or, you know, the moon was ripped away from the Earth. And that's really happening in reality. A few centimeters, I'm trying to remember, I want to quote you a number, a few centimeters per century or something on that order, very, very slowly. I apologize, I don't know the exact number. But it is slowly moving away because of tides and that energy is being lost by tidal dissipation in the Earth-Moon system. And so that slowly moves the moon away from the Earth. And
Here's a science fiction question for you. We always talk about something hitting the Earth. Mm-hmm. What if something hit the moon and hit the moon hard enough to actually send it out of its current orbit around the Earth? What effect would that have on the Earth?
Well, it would change certainly the tides. The moon is a major cause of the ocean tides. So that all those cycles that fishermen and people who live along the coast are used to would change dramatically. It would also be a big loss to all the poets and romantics of the world, right?
Oh, it sure would.
No more full moon in the sky. Some people have hypothesized that the moon actually helped life on Earth form originally by keeping the Earth's orbit stable and creating these nice tidal environments that are changing in some rhythmic pattern. It's not clear to me that if somehow the moon were to be catastrophically yanked away from us, that it would dramatically change life on Earth, except for, you know, the cycles of tides and life forms that rely on tide pools and things like that. It would dramatically affect those ecosystems. But I would wager that that people
we'd survive.
I wouldn't want to do the experiment, but I would bet people could survive.
Okay. Can PanCam help find the missing Mars surveyor, perhaps by taking long exposures of the sky, bracketing the time when surveyors expected to pass over either rover, thus pinning down its present orbit for MRO imaging?
Yeah, I wish we could, but I think the answer is no, because for two reasons. One, the cameras are not as sensitive as a telescope. Okay, and the orbiters are just tiny little things way up in the sky, and so you need very, very sensitive cameras. And we've actually looked for several of the orbiters in the past with the cameras on the surface, and we were not able to find them. So I don't know if we have the sensitivity. And we've tried previously and failed. The other reason that might not be possible is because you want the orbiter to be in the sunlight as it's passing over, and the way that the orbit of that spacecraft is oriented, it's usually in the dark when it's passing over. It's usually in the shadow, or not in the direct sunlight when it's passing over the landing site. And so it's like when you go out in the early evening and look for satellites in Earth's skies, you see them best right after sunset when they're still reflecting the sun high above you before they sort of rotate around into Earth's dark side. And it's similar on Mars, and those are the best times that we've looked is when they were predicted to be reflecting the sunlight, and we couldn't find them. We have, those of us on the camera team haven't been asked by anyone higher up on the org chart of the rover project to try this search, I think because they realize that the cameras might not be sensitive enough and the spacecraft isn't in the right orbit. But if we're asked to do it, we'll certainly give it a shot. Another factor is that it's winter time at both rover sites, and so it's a very, very low power situation. It's hard to have enough power to run the rovers at night and then make sure that they'll survive the next day.
Here's a far-out question for you. I'm going to give you a lot of those, Professor. And it's, you know, we know roughly the current condition of Mars. Is there anything that we could do as humans if we had enough money to change Mars in any way, to change the climate? Certainly, man, as you mentioned, is beginning to change the climate of Earth without trying that hard. It's just what we're doing. If we actually wanted to change the climate of Mars, or in some form terraform Mars, is that a reasonable thing to contemplate?
Absolutely, it can be done. What you need is two things. One, you've already mentioned money, and the other thing that you didn't mention is time. It takes an enormous amount of time to do things like that, and there have actually been very, very good scientific studies done by colleagues of mine, a guy named Chris McKay at the Ames Research Center, for example. Others who work with him and have worked before on this problem have thought about this issue. You know, what if you were to, for example, plant some kind of lichen or moss that could give off oxygen and that could live on the polar caps, or that could somehow survive in the Martian soil if it does turn out to have nutrients in it, which we don't know, and slowly change the environment of Mars. It's possible. Certainly, life slowly changed the climate of the Earth by introducing all this oxygen into our environment, but it took millions and millions of years. It's not something I don't think we have the technology to do quickly. You know, they may have that technology on Star Trek, but that's just not the real world. And it's not the foreseeable future either. So I think you're talking many centuries. First of all, we have to get to Mars and be able to understand it in more detail and find out what, if any, organisms that soil, those polar caps, can host. And then to start the experiment, it would be a slow process. But I think it's doable. It's definitely doable. It would require a lot of money, a lot of time, and some significant commitment to do that.
So we're not ready to launch Genesis.
It's not happening yet.
Another question that we can handle after the break, because it's coming up. Eventually, there are going to be missions that are going to bring back samples from Mars, rocks and dirt and whatever we can get our hands on, our mechanical hands on, I suppose.
Right.
How much danger is there, Professor, in bringing something back from Mars? Now, again, we don't know. We just would, I guess, grab handfuls of something or another and mechanically store it and then bring it back to Earth. We can talk about how that would happen. What I'm wondering is how dangerous it conceivably might be to do that. So, Professor, hold tight. We'll come back and get the answer to that question. But who knows what might come back? I'm Art Bell. Yes, all the way over here in Typhoon Alley. Hi, everybody. My guest is Professor Jim Bell, and he's running the little machines that are scurrying around Mars, taking all kinds of wonderful pictures. And so in a moment, we're going to ask about this danger of bringing something back. I think it's planned in a mission coming up pretty soon. Can you imagine? Little tiny things. They've always been the bane of man. Even now, we worry about them. We call them things like Ebola and the terrible, horrible flus that emanate from here in Asia and then infect the rest of the world, things like bird flu. We worry about them. These are the Earth-born things. What might be on Mars? Actually, this is a dual question, Professor. Let me begin by asking, the early Mars missions that we had, did we by any chance infect Mars with life?
That is a really good question, Art. Just to back up, put a little context into that, there are actually protocols that have been established by the United Nations, among others, NASA, space agencies around the world, that that dictate how and whether we can contaminate the surface of another planet by sending spacecraft to the moon or astronauts to the moon or spacecraft to Mars or wherever.
Right.
And they're very strict. And there's actually someone who works at NASA called the Planetary Protection Officer whose job it is to make sure that these protocols are met and that we're not knowingly, intentionally infecting, in quotes, or contaminating the surfaces of other worlds with Earth life forms. Of course, one of the things we want to do is find out if there's life out there. So the worst possible thing we could do is screw up the experiment, right, by bringing
yes.
life with us.
That's right.
So, and of course, if there is something alive out there, we don't want to risk infecting it, killing it, modifying it, changing it in some way. We want to, you know, be respectful of that. So there have been protocols, but it's not clear if you go back to the entire history of the space program, and there's a bunch of Russian missions, for example, that we still know very little about openly in the West.
Yes.
To the moon and even to Mars, and what kinds of protocols and procedures were taken on those. Even perhaps some of the early NASA missions before this started to become a very serious international topic. It's not clear that that they were held to the same standards as missions today are held. So it's an excellent question, and there are a lot of clever people trying to think about that, and I hope the answer is that we have not contaminated other planets. But
well, we now have an officer. We don't call him the Prime Directive Officer.
We don't. Planetary Protection. That really is a position at NASA. Yeah.
So that is a possibility. Now the opposite. Do we have missions already on the books that are going to bring back Martian samples?
Well, unfortunately, we don't have anything on the books. There are ideas. There was a plan for Mars sample return, it's called, on the books almost a few years ago, but with all of the latest big budget crises in the government for this kind of exploration, a lot of that has been scaled back. And so there are ideas and certainly a lot of interest in the scientific community, even in the general public, for going to Mars, most likely with a robotic mission, scooping up some rocks and dirt, like you said earlier, and bringing them back. And that's not, it's a hard thing to do, but it's not impossible. I mean, you know, the Russians did that with robots to the moon back in the 60s, for example. So it's technologically within our reach, but just sort of not been approved yet, and the funding hasn't been found yet to do that, although I think most of us believe it's sometime in the next next decade, the 2010s, we'll try to do that.
All right. I would assume that anything brought back would be treated like you would treat a level 4 virus. Is that fair?
Absolutely, and for two reasons. One that you talked about earlier, you know, we do not want to take the chance, even if it's remote, even if it's a minuscule chance, we do not want to take the chance of introducing some bizarre alien virus or whatever bacteria into our ecosystem. You know, and I think most people who study this issue seriously don't think there's much of a chance, but it's not zero. And so as long as it's not zero, you want to take every possible precaution and treat any samples that come back with the utmost respect and care, just, you know, similar to what was done when the Apollo astronauts came back from the moon. Remember, they were in quarantine for many days. And so that kind of an approach goes into the, you know, estimating the cost of one of these missions of bringing samples back and whether you have to then bring them, for example, to the space station instead of to the surface of the Earth to be studied in detail. Or have
any good science fiction writer would tell you that if, I mean, after all, there might be water below the surface, and if there is a virus-like or some sort of something that lives at the bacterial level, it might be extremely hardy, and to then set it loose in an Earth environment, it might really go berserk. So,
right. So that's absolutely, you're absolutely right. That's one reason. The other reason, which a lot of people don't think about, is that, you know, we want to find out if there's anything alive or was alive there. And so the last thing we want to do is contaminate those samples with anything that's living or was living on the Earth. Because otherwise we might get the impression, if we contaminated a soil sample with Earth bacteria, that, oh my gosh, there's bacteria just like the Earth on Mars. So we have to keep the ecosystems, if you will, completely separate, as absolutely separate as possible, both for safety reasons and for scientific sort of biologic reasons in studying Mars.
All right, here comes another Richard question. In the 19th century, serious mainstream scientists proposed creating a huge geometric feature on Earth, something like a big triangle, say, in the Sahara Desert, filling it with oil, lighting it up so Martians, if they existed, which we didn't know then, could see through their telescopes that there was, in fact, intelligent life here on Earth, which obviously knew fundamental mathematics and geometry, and therefore was intelligent. Now it's the 21st century. We've got lasers, telescopes, spacecraft. Can the PanCam on the rovers, in a time exposure, see a visible laser beam sent from Earth? And if so, how big would the laser have to be, and how big a telescope would it have to be sent backwards through to Mars, and when?
Yeah, that would be a fun experiment to try. My estimate would be no, that we would not be able to see that. Again, it comes down to two issues. One is the sensitivity of the camera for taking pictures of astronomical objects is not very high. You also have to remember that the Earth is a morning or an evening star on Mars, just like Venus is for us. So it's always in the twilight sky. So it's never in the pitch black sky. So it's already lost a bunch of contrast. It's also, the Earth is only about the size of one or so picture elements in the camera. So we don't, you know, we've seen the Earth in our pictures, but it appears just as a point-like star in the sky, and so unfortunately, I don't think we'd have the sensitivity to do that experiment. It'd be a cool thing.
Is the Mars sky itself actually, if we were standing on the surface of Mars, would we see a reddish color in the sky? There are people who say it's blue.
Yeah, no, we would see a reddish color, and it's similar to the colors that we see in the sky on the Earth after there's been a big volcanic eruption. You know, Mount Pinatubo in your neighborhood went off not too long ago, and we got around the world. We were blessed with these beautiful reddish sunsets because of all the dust that was injected into the atmosphere of the Earth. And it's the same process on Mars. We know Mars has a lot of dust in its atmosphere. The famous Mars dust storms sometimes completely cover the surface from view. We've seen that, you know, several times in the spacecraft era, and people going back to the 19th century with telescopes saw that as well. So we know there's a lot of dust there. It's a very thin atmosphere. That combination produces this, and to call it red is the wrong word, because when you say red, you sort of think of fire engine, right? It's not red that way. It's more like brownish, yellowish, orangish, and the color changes with the time of day. And just like the Earth sky, depending on how close to the sun you're looking. If you go out on a nice clear day on Earth and it's blue sky, but as you look closer to the sun, it gets kind of whiter. The color changes. The same is true on Mars. Time of day, the color changes. If you put more dust in the atmosphere, there's a lot of dust storms going on. It's a deeper brownish red color. If there's less dust in the atmosphere, it's a more a lighter yellowish color. So, you know, it's dynamic. To say that there's one color of the sky is not correct, just like it isn't correct on the Earth. But on average, it's sort of a reddish brown. One of the things that we found with the rover cameras that was also seen with the Mars Pathfinder and the Viking cameras is that it's kind of a cool thing. It's opposite the Earth sky. You know, Earth sky is normally blue during the day, and as the sun is setting, you get these reddish skies as the sun goes into all that dust and smog if you live in L.A. On Mars, when this during the middle of the day, the skies are this kind of reddish-brownish color. And as the sun is setting, the sky, especially around the sun, starts to turn bluish because of the way the dust scatters light. And it's going to be just a beautiful, dramatic sight when people go, and it's going to be a completely different realm of poets and romantic writing about the colors of the Martian sky, which are sort of opposite the colors of the Earth sky.
Speaking of going, we have not even been back yet to the moon with man. And for many of us, me included, that's, I don't know, it's kind of discouraging. In fact, almost to the point where I've asked from a conspiratorial point of view why we have not been back to the moon. It's bizarre to me that we went, we did it, and we haven't gone back.
Yeah.
Was it so disinteresting? Was it so without value that it simply isn't worth the money to go back, or what?
Well, that's an excellent question, and I wish I knew the answer. I mean, I was part, and many people in my generation were partly inspired by the Apollo mission, the voyages of these incredible people to go to the moon, to get into science and exploration of space. And I want to see NASA doing big things like that, risky things, pushing the envelope of human exploration of science. So it's, you know, it's incredibly discouraging to me, who grew up on this, to not see us doing that. And I don't want to be a negativist, but I think really what it comes down to, unfortunately, is money. It's discretionary funding. It's discretionary spending on the part of our government to do these things. To send people into space is not yet, or if ever, within the realm of individual billionaires or corporations. It has to be governments to come up with this kind of money to do it. And it just hasn't been, since Apollo, it has not been a national priority to do this. It was a national priority then, partly because of the space race and the need to beat the Russians. Maybe it'll become a national priority again if for example, that the Chinese become very serious into space exploration, which they're showing interest in doing. But it's just, we're not there. We don't have the national commitment of you know, dedicated funding to do this. And, you know, we have so many other problems as a nation and ways to spend money to help people and wars and hurricanes, and you know, I mean, there's a lot of pull on our tax dollars, and who wants to pay more taxes, right? So I think that's what it comes down to. It's a little discouraging because that's not the the sort of optimistic, forward-looking future that I thought we'd have 20-30
All right, let's talk for a second about the private sector. It's not that there's nothing going on. For example, a very good friend of mine, Robert Bigelow, as you know, has launched a spacecraft and has eventual plans to try and put a hotel in space.
Yep. No, and I think that's that there is a definite future in that. There's a definite future in space tourism. There's a definite future in individual entrepreneurs, business people reaching out into the space frontier. I think those days are coming, but still a dedicated long-term program of getting astronauts into low Earth orbit, sending them to asteroids, sending them to the moon, sending them to Mars, is still only within the reach of one or more governments working together to put that kind of money together.
That said, how has NASA's attitude about the kind of thing that Robert Bigelow and some others are doing, how has it morphed over time? I know that in the beginning you guys weren't really all that wild about the private sector going to space. Has that changed?
Well, I don't speak for NASA. I don't work for NASA. I'm a professor at Cornell University, so I can cheer NASA or I can boo them. It doesn't matter. You know, my job's secure that way. But so I don't speak for the NASA administrator or whatever. But my my impression is that that at least the current administration in NASA and even the current administration in Washington is very supportive of efforts to privatize space and to seek ways to, you know, ease the government's burden on getting payloads into Earth orbit and eventually getting people up there. It's still, you know, I think there's a small amount of NASA funding that goes to support that. I don't personally see evidence of antagonism, and just as a personal private citizen and a scientist, I support it. I think it's a good idea.
I think there may have been a bit of antagonism early on when NASA sort of regarded space as their own.
Yeah, maybe.
For a number of years, kind of their own private domain.
Like a competitive spirit, maybe.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
that's
sure,
right.
Sure. Maybe it's only human nature.
Perhaps so. But it is discouraging that we have not moved forward. Do you think something basic has changed? I mean, aside from the money angle of it, do you think something has, governments ultimately are pretty much responsive to what people want, and if the people were clamoring for men to go back to the moon and Mars, I think that ultimately it would happen, but we're not clamoring for that for some reason.
Yeah, well, maybe if I could wax philosophical a little bit and claim that maybe we're a bit jaded on all this stuff as a society. You know, as a nation and our media don't really pay attention, for example, to the space shuttle unless it blows up and kills heroic astronauts, and then we pay attention. But you know, it seems to have come to pass that we take a lot of these things for granted, that we think of them as routine. I don't think exploring space is ever going to be routine, just like going in a submarine to the bottom of the ocean is never going to be routine. But maybe things like, you know, the fact that you can hop in a jet and be almost anywhere on the Earth in a weekend has sort of taken some of the edge off of this and made it seem less dramatic, less risky, less of an adventure than it really is. I know there's an enormous number of people, including many people in Congress, that really support space exploration and really understand that this is the human race pushing ourselves as hard as we can, sometimes failing, but many times succeeding. And that's a noble thing to spend a small bit of our wealth on. But maybe as a society, not enough of us feel that way. And, boy, I'd like to see more of that.
Gee, I would too. And there are a number of theoretical physicists who believe that we ultimately are going to have to find a way to live off our planet and to get human beings off our planet, because there's a great chance that this this cycle we talked about early on that may have occurred to Mars and may eventually occur to Earth will occur again, And if we want to see the human race continue in some form, we're going to have to learn to live elsewhere.
Oh, look, I mean, the Earth has been hit by asteroids and comets in the past, and it will be hit again. It's not a question of if, it's going to happen. And you know, this is one reason why the Congress has supported NASA in searching for asteroids and comets that could potentially hit the Earth using telescopes, using the giant radio telescope in Arecibo in Puerto Rico and other telescopes around the world. You know, this is an important national issue now, national defense issue, if you will. And it is going to happen. It may not be in our lifetimes. It might not be in our kids' lifetimes. It could be tomorrow. The more we can do to protect ourselves and prepare as a species, I think the better off we'll be.
All right. When we come back, Professor, we'll allow the audience to ask questions. I've held you for 2 hours. I do want to ask a little more about deflecting some nasty object that might be headed our way.
Sounds great.
But we'll open the phone lines. All right, Professor, hold tight. We'll be right back. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM.